you are listening to a English version of That's Life in Sweden, or as it's called in Swedish, Sånt är livet i Sverige, with me, Lisa Orsimäki. And today I will be talking with Ingmar Skog. He's a professor of psychiatry at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden, and he's also the center director of AgeCap, researching into areas such as aging and health. Hello and welcome to the program, Ingmar Skog. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine, thank you. Just after the summer holidays.
Yes, back to work?
No, not really, half back to work.
Oh, okay. 50%?
50%, you could say. Well, I'm starting to work full time next week, but this week I'm
quite occupation. Okay, so you had a good summer and good break?
I think so, yeah. I had a time with my grandchildren and children in our country house, and then I had some days at my own apartment in Gothenburg.
Okay, lovely. Good to hear. I'm just thinking about today we're going to talk about aging and health. These are, of course, your areas of expertise. And so I'm curious, what do you mean by ageism or aging?
Well, ageism is that people have preconceptions and different prejudices against older people. It's like when you have, and you look at people as one group of people who are old and not worth very much. That's ageism. You can compare that with, for instance, racism, where you have certain preconceptions because people come from a certain age, a race, and you put them all together in one group. And one of the problems for ageism in Sweden is that it's very good accepted. It's quite okay to joke about people because they are old. And we have very much preconceptions about whether older people can be politicians, which I think is very much counteracted by Barbara Westerholm, who is our oldest person in parliament. She is 88 years old and extremely active in different fields, for instance, in relation to aging. And this could be compared to a country like United States, where both the candidates for the presidency were about 870, far over 870, and almost close to age 80. And also the leading politicians have also been much older than is generally in Sweden. In Sweden, you would never think about anyone being a leader for one of the parties when they are about 860, not being elected at least when they are about 860.
Really? So why is understanding aging important?
Well, it's very important to counteract all these prejudices. That is that we need to inform people about what aging is. Both, I mean, the good things and the bad things with aging. I mean, one thing with aging is that you get more and more experienced, and you get more and more experience about life and about what's happening in life with older age. On the other hand, you get a little bit worse memory. You have, of course, your physics is getting worse and so on. But I think we often overestimate in our conversations about the bad things about aging, and not talk enough about the good parts of aging.
Okay. So can you then explain, because you talk about being 70 is the new 50.
Yeah. And that is because in Gothenburg, we have had these population studies since 1971, and we look at different birth cohorts. And the first birth cohort was born 1901, and the last one was born 1944, and we have examined a lot of 70-year-olds after that too. And next year, we are actually going to look at 70-year-olds born 1952. And then we follow these birth cohorts all over their rest of their lives to see what is really happening with aging. But that means that we are able to compare people from different birth cohorts when they are at the same age. And we can see how aging is different between different birth cohorts. And what we find is enormous differences. We were really so surprised in the beginning that we thought we had done something wrong. But you can see every parameter we're looking at looks better in later born birth cohorts than in earlier cohorts. And that is, for instance, we have tested intellectual function since 1971. And if we compare people born 1901 with people born 1944, there are enormous differences in how they perform these psychological testings. And in some of them, they are 50 to 100% better in the later birth cohorts, despite that the tests were actually done for people living in the 1970s. So intellectual function is much, much better. But also when we test things like physical function, which we test in many different ways, we can also see large differences, even large differences the last 15 years. And this means that older people today are much better, both in intellectual function and in physical function. And that made us talk about 70 is the new 50.
Right. And you also talk about 70s being the 20s, being a new, you know, being like 20-year-olds. What do you mean by that?
Well, it actually started with quite a funny thing. I was in Sweden. We have these political meetings every year in Almedalen.
Right.
And a lot of people come both from university, politics, industry, and so on, come to this Almedalen for a week to have debates, discussions, and so on. And I was invited by the University of Gothenburg to talk about 70 is the new 50. And when I looked at the program on the airplane to Gotland, I actually found out that they had written 70 is the new 20. So I had to change my talk and think how I should make it in relation to this new title. And what I was thinking about then was that the attitude among people who become 70 is quite different from it was 50 years ago. So when you had people who were 70 50 years ago, they were happy that they had an okay pension. They were happy that they had an okay apartment or housing. Because they have had very poor circumstances in their early life. If you look at a 70-year-old today, they are more thinking about doing everything they didn't have time to do when they were younger, and they want to do it before they become too old. So in the same way as a 20-year-old want to do everything before they get settled with work and family and so on, a 70-year-old want to do everything they haven't done before before they get too old. So then we start to talk about 70s, the new 20.
Right. So they're more capable also doing things that they didn't have the opportunity to do when they were in their 20s.
Well, or didn't do because they think they had all the time in the world. I mean, one thing you understand when you get older is that you really understand you don't have that much time left. When you're 20, you can see an ocean of years in front of you that you can't really do when you are 70 or 75.
Right. So you have to make the most of it.
Exactly.
So
today's 70-year-olds, I mean, the younger old people are really into that today.
Right. So what about the 20-year-olds? How do they compare, today's 20-year-olds compare with the 70-year-olds?
Well, it's interesting because what we find is that today's 70-year-olds compared to previous generations of 70-year-olds, they have more sex, they drink more alcohol, and they are less depressed. And if we look at 20-year-olds today, they are actually having less sex, drink less alcohol, and are more depressed. So sometimes I used to talk about the 20 is the new 70.
Right. Okay, all right. So what's the reaction you get then?
People are laughing as you did.
I think it's hilarious. So, but surely there are reasons why 20-year-olds today might not be as happy.
I think there are a lot of things. One very important thing, I think, is today you have all these media. You know, when I was young, you could drink alcohol and you could do bad things, but you no one had a movie to show you. Today, you need to be very careful, because if you do something foolish, someone may actually make a film of you and send it out to the whole school. And that, I think, makes people much more afraid of doing things. I mean, really living out life, because if you do something wrong, everyone will see it. I think that's an important thing. You can't really party in the same way as you did when we were young. The other thing is probably that people are also very much more worried about health and climate and what is going to happen with the world. I think my generation was that too, but not really in the same way. So I think people are more worried, but I think also, especially these things, that you need to show a very good picture of yourself because of all the different digital media we have today.
Mm-hmm. It plays a major role in young people's lives.
Yeah, and I think that makes you get another type of pressure. Mm-hmm. You can't really try everything as we did when we were young, because if you do something wrong, people may see it and the nice picture of you will disappear.
Yes, exactly. It's a bit, yeah, it is a it definitely is a concern. Just going back a little bit to the aging then, are there any differences between men and women in relation to aging?
Well, I mean, one of the first thing you need to think about is that women live much longer than men. But what we find in our studies is that men and women become more similar, both when it comes to intellectual function, in relation to physical function, even in relation to personality.
Right.
And many other things. So we could say that if we have more of an equal society today, which older people today have lived in, compared to the previous generations, it might mean that men and women becomes more similar. And that also has to do with, for instance, depression. It's well known that depression is more common in women than in men, and that is for all ages. But what we could see is that in 70-year-olds, the prevalence of depression declined from 1971 to 2014, when we did the last study on 70-year-olds. And the other thing we saw was that the gap between men and women decreased. So it became more similar when it comes to depression. But we also really find that it in physical function also.
Mm-hmm. So can you explain, what do you mean? What are some of the causes for depression among 70-year-olds? If you know, and I'm thinking here about women.
Well, I think it's the same causes as for younger people. You know, depression is very, very common. Generally, most studies find that you have what we call a point prevalence. If you do a study at a certain time, the prevalence of depression comes to be about 10%. And in life, it's very, very common. We did a study where we followed women for over 50 years, a population study, and we found that almost 70% had a clinical depression sometimes during their life, and almost half had a serious depression sometime during their life. So it's very, very common. And I think if you follow men in the same way, you will find it's very common in men too, although it's more common in women. But all disorders which are common like this are have a lot of different risk factors, because that's why they are so common. And it's everything from social factors, social isolation, loneliness, loss of work. If you have a bad relation or spouses or close people to you die and so on, all these things together with a lot of other things may increase your risk to get a more serious depression.
Right.
In old age, what we see there is more of, you see more biological factors. I mean, the social factors are very important also when you are Yeah, but what you can see is that you get, as we age, we get more disorders. We can't get around that. We get more disorders. And some of these disorders, physical disorders, increase our risk for depression. For instance, if you have vascular changes in your brain, which we found is a very strong risk factor for getting depression, and that becomes more common as a risk factor when you get older. But it's interesting because, you know, as I said before, women are at a high risk for depression, but women are also living longer. And being lonely or losing your spouse is generally thought to be a risk factor, especially among men. So many studies actually found that losing your spouse is a risk factor for depression in men, but seems to be protective in women. In our own studies, we actually didn't find that it was protective for women. We did find that losing your spouse was a risk factor for men, and it didn't really matter for women. Really? But this is found in, it didn't make any change in women. And this is an interesting thing because it seems like men are much more vulnerable for losing your spouse. Not only because of death, but men are also much more vulnerable after a divorce. So, I mean, on the group level.
Right.
And it's often explained that women has more close friends. But it might also be that men really need to have someone with them to a larger extent than women. Women might be more independent.
Right. When you mention, when you talk about the depression, what I'm curious about that, because I'm thinking of when we have children, when women have children, you go through this postpartum depression. And you know, I certainly did have some, but it wasn't a deep depression as I found from my my girlfriends who had children. Would that have any effect on this kind of idea of depression among women? I mean, are biology is a bit different.
Well, one of the things is that it's often talked about that hormones in women is one reason why women have a higher frequency of depression, higher than men. It might to a certain extent explain it. We don't really know why it is like this. I mean, why women have a higher lifetime risk for depression. But other things could be social factors, especially in early generation where women were often home with the children and being a housewives and so on, which might have led to depression. I mean, it's not like that anymore to the same extent as it was previously, but it might also, it might be social factors. But what we see now is that the difference between men and women when it comes to the prevalence of depression in older people is decreasing. Right. So there are changes. So I think, once again, I think there are many different reasons why we have a higher prevalence and incidence of depression in women.
Right. Yes. I'm curious about those why someone among elderly, and I'm thinking when you said about the earlier generations among women, they were homekeepers, they had brought up the children, and then once the children leave and they get their own lives, maybe, you know, the woman, you know, lost part of her because it's they identified so much with the role of being the homemaker.
I think I can agree on that. I think that is probably, could very well be one reason. But to counteract that, most studies actually don't find that depression increases very much in women after, for instance, menopause.
Right.
It seems to be very little difference, despite what people generally think.
Oh, okay. That's news. I thought when you go through menopause, that that's when you are actually experiencing that you're not yourself and you breathe down and not looking at the bright side of life as often. But I suppose it's also individual.
Well, it's actually, this was actually found already 50 years ago by Ture Hellström in one of our studies. And because he followed women before and after menopause in a study. And it has been shown in a number of studies.
Okay.
But it's one of these myths which are ongoing everywhere.
You know, we got lots of myths.
Yeah.
We got lots of myths, and I'm so glad you're pulling me up on every single one of them, because I got lots of myths. You know, you have this kind of ideas. Oh, well, this will happen and that will happen and this is why it happened. And I'm just thinking to myself, well, women's bodies has got a lot to do with, I suppose, I don't know about the emotional, mental health well-being, but men has similar. After what you just explained, men are very similar. I mean, they also feel very vulnerable at certain stages in their lives.
Yeah, I think you're completely right in that. And especially previous, actually, one of the myths is that depression increases very much after retirement. It really doesn't. It even seems to it that depression decreases after retirement. But I think it's very, very individual. For some people, where work has been very important and part of your way of being, so to say.
Yes, part of
the
our
picture of yourself. Yeah. Then I think it could be a vulnerable thing. But on a group level, if we don't find any increase of depression after retirement,
right.
Rather vice versa.
That's good news.
Yeah, maybe it's. But it's what I could think sometimes, I wonder, is that what I hear from many people is that, you know, the first years after retirement is wonderful because it's like having a very long holiday.
Mm.
But then after a while, you get a little bit bored because you don't really have the same position in society anymore. I think the best thing for people would really be if we could have more part-time retirements where people still have the contact with their work, give with their experience.
Yes.
Because when, you know, what is often said is that you need to get people out of work so the young people can come back. But what happens is when the older worker or the older person gets out in Sweden now at the age of 68, the next year or 2 years, from 2 years on, it will be 69 years, which is the compulsory retirement age in Sweden. But what the working place loses then is the experience.
Yes.
And the knowledge, which is, you know, the silent knowledge.
Yes.
Which only comes up when you get a problem. Mm. I can take my own example. I mean, I worked with these studies for 40, 45 years. And today, I think my younger PhD students and postdocs and senior researchers are much more smarter than I am. But they can come into a problem which they can't solve. And I'm out traveling. I haven't been that the last years, of course, but I've been out somewhere. And then when I come back and they worked on it for 1 or 2 weeks, I can often solve it in 5 minutes because I've seen all these problems before. And I think that's so in many working places, that when the older person at work disappears, you lose a lot of knowledge, which might actually be very counterproductive for the working place.
You know, I can only agree with you there. Absolutely, 100%. And that, of course, brings up the question about some of the concerns in relation to aging and how we treat our elderly or those who... I mean, I just got a bit of a problem with this word, elderly. I like the word mature-aged.
Yeah, it's we always try to find different... Seniors is also a very nice word. Or a nicer word, because I agree. Elderly, the word elderly gives a lot of prejudices.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. But it's very difficult to find a better word also. I mean, we have a lot of different words in Swedish, which I really can't translate to English now. But it's still so that we talk about elderly or older people, it should be in English today.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's really interesting because I thought of, well, you know, this word aging and elderly, I just have problems with it. So I looked up different, you know, how we have stages of growth, human growth, and we start from the infant, we come into child early years, then we come into adolescence, then we come into, but there it comes to, I think it goes from middle or adolescence to adult or middle age or something. It kind of jumped, and I thought, what happened to the mature aged person? Because you can have 70-year-olds who act like 30-year-olds.
Yeah. It's. I think we should probably talk, as I said, sometimes is that we need to think about more about birth year than about age. Because what we see in our studies is that the differences between different birth years
right.
are more different than between different ages.
You know, our unwillingness to include and utilize the expertise and experience and knowledge of these retirees or who go on retirement, say at 65 or 67, I really think I can only agree with you that we're really missing out on a lot of valuable knowledge from these individuals. What can we do? Is there something that can be done, or is it actually a problem, a system problem?
I think it's a lot of different things. One thing is the system problem, because at least until now, we have had an absolute retirement age in Sweden where you have to leave. And it's actually now they changed the law, so it's easier to let for the employer to let your employees continue. Because they, you know, in Sweden, it's if someone is, we have a thing which protect the worker very much, because you can't really get rid of someone. But previously, it was so that this when you come to the, you know, the last retirement age previously, you had about a couple of months where the employer could actually tell you, now you have to retire.
Right.
But then this rule that you can't fire someone without a lot of explanations started to work again. But now this has taken away after, it's now after age 68 next year, and the year after that it's 69. And after that age, you don't have that law anymore, which means that it's easier for the employer to keep people, older right. people at work.
Right.
But there are, if we talk about prejudices when it comes to retirement, one prejudice which is often heard is that older people who get this, become 68 or 69, that they need to retire because to give the work for a younger person. But that is a very big myth. According to economists, it's not like that at all. It's rather so that the more people we keep in the working force, they, so to say, produce more work for others. You know, it's very interesting, because the same argument saying that was about when women wanted to start to come into the working force.
Yep.
Then one of the biggest arguments was that the man was the one who, you know, gave the money to the family. And if women came out on the working market, then it would be more men who would be unemployed. But that was not really true. And it's really the same thing when it comes to whether older people continue to work.
Right.
And I think, you know, the retirement age you have in a certain, in a country, I also think give people, maybe even unconsciously, a feeling that after that age, you cannot work anymore. You can't produce anything for society. You can't give anything for society, because you have this age where you have to retire. For instance, in the United States, they don't have that age. You can even be sued if you fire someone because of age. And that means that a lot of people continues. Sometimes it could be a bad thing, but you don't have the same aging thing as we have in, for instance, Sweden.
And I'm thinking about a lot of the women who kind of, I think I read somewhere that in Sweden, the perfect age for a woman working is when she's 36.
That, why should it be like that?
I have no idea. And if you're over 40, well, then you're a bit too old. I'm just not sure where these ideas and where this comes from, but if I'm thinking of Australia, in Australia, if you're 40, you're too old.
In Australia?
Yes.
Interesting. Because in Sweden, it's really the same thing, that after 40, it's getting more difficult to get to work. And the interesting thing, I heard one a couple of years ago that it was actually some sort of an experiment by some of the car factories in Germany, that they wanted to know the difference between older workers and younger workers. So they actually put younger workers in one factory and older workers in another factory. And it turned out that the younger workers were much, much quicker. But it was much more effective in the older group, because the younger factory, they made much more mistakes.
Yes.
In the long run, it was much more effective with the older workers, because they didn't make so much mistakes and they didn't need to do so much corrections, which I think is a very interesting example of between the good thing about older age.
So, you know, what do you think are some solutions, if you like, to combat these kind of myths and the way we are thinking about someone as being old? And what kind of solutions? Do you have any ideas?
Well, first of all, it's information. People really need to know what is aging. And then I think we have to have more and more positive pictures for people, more positive pictures of older people, more ways where we actually find that older people can be fun, can be productive, can be artists, can be all kind of different, very good pictures for other people. And we need to take away the negative thing about aging and put forward positive pictures.
And I think you are a wonderful example of a positive picture of an elderly gentleman or mature age man.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I get a little bit afraid if you think about me as an older gentleman. But I think it's we need to think more about that. I think we do have so much prejudices about age in Sweden, and we really need to do something about it and change it. And yes, we need to have more working places where you actually mix younger and older people, but also more social places where actually older and younger people meet.
Yes. You know, that brings me to a brilliant program where you were one of the two experts. I think you did some kind of experiment. It was actually a television program where there were 10 elderly individuals at an aged care or nursing home, and who met with 4-year-olds, 10 4-year-olds. And apparently you did some testing before and after. It was a 6-week experiment. And I read briefly, and I have looked at the, I saw the programs, and I thought it was just brilliant. But what I'm interested in finding out, if you can share some of the results, and what exactly did you test?
Well, first of all, we, you know, it was so that it's like not a scientific study, but the tests we used were the usual ones we do in scientific testings of cognitive function. So we tested things like memory, executive function, visuospatial ability, language, and all these kind of things. Also, quickness of responses and so on. And it was the usual tests. And then we also used a very simple test, which are used everywhere. I think the Mini-Mental State Examination, which is like, you could say it's a very crude test. For people in old age, in the old age area, it's like blood pressure in the medical area.
Okay.
You do the test, but you don't get any details of what is really done. But it generally works quite well. But we also did very, very sophisticated testing. And we also looked at physical function, we looked at depression, we looked at life satisfaction and so on. And the thing was that when me and the other, Anna Ekdahl, the geriatrician, we were the experts, when we actually tested people in the beginning, we thought we wouldn't see anything because we thought they were too bad. And then they started to have this nursery or these child experiments to see the children every morning for 6 weeks.
Right.
And they did a lot of things together. They painted together. They were out walking together. They grew up with chickens together and so on. They did a lot of different things.
Mm.
And what we saw was that the older people in the group became more and more active, did more and more things.
Mm.
And when we tested them, the results were absolutely fantastic. Some people increased 4 to 5 points in this mini mental state examination,
right,
which is something you would never expect. And they also became, all of them become better on the more sensitive tests, all of them. And they also got much more happy about life and so on. And for me, the lesson was really that I don't think we cured Alzheimer's disease with this experiment.
Mm.
But what I realized was that many people in old age care, and maybe even older people living at home, have too little of stimulation which they think is interesting.
Mm.
And that means that people are performing in a much better, a much worse way than they need to do. We also saw that the 10 older people also start get better to do their activities of daily living. So even if it was not a scientific experiment, I think that we wouldn't have seen these changes without the program.
I think that was an absolute fantastic program to watch. It was so uplifting, and you know, it really showed how when you engage people, even our elderly and, you know, particularly those who are more frail, when you engage them and you provide activities, and I was just blown away. I thought, my God, what a brilliant program. And I certainly hope they would, excuse me, be able to provide that in English. And
it is in English.
It is in English.
It has actually been on English television or also Australian television.
What a wonderful thing.
In Britain, it was one of the biggest successes they have had, I think. So it's actually gone 2 seasons in Britain. And in Australia, it was also a very big success. But it's also been in Netherlands and some other countries.
That is just, it was such a wonderful, wonderful program. I'm so happy to, I remember I was so happy when I was watching it, and I thought to myself, this is exactly what life is about. So just because you're frail and you're ill, and you know, people always think that when you go into a nursing home, well, it is the last, that's it, the end of life. And so in order to make their lives if you like, better or more, a little bit more meaningful, the program that you implemented or the experiment, that was, and I thought to myself, well, it wouldn't cost anything.
No, it's probably very, I should say that a lot of communities in Sweden now want to start to do it. They looked at the program also and think it's a good idea. So it's probably coming in different parts of Sweden now in the near future.
Are you going to follow those programs, or is there someone who's going to follow up on those programs, you know, do similar kind of testing and then look at the results? And
well, I think some of my people who have collaborated in our center are going to work with this. I've also been asked to look at it, but more oversee things.
Right.
But I think it's a good idea. And I think it's one idea. I think what is very important, you know, part of these blue zones. The blue zones are parts of the world where people, you have much more 100-year-olds than you would expect.
Right.
And one thing which is common for this is that generally, even the 100-year-olds have some sort of a duty in the society.
Mm.
And I think this is extremely important, that you feel that you are contributing to society in one way or another, or that you take part in society in one way or another.
Mm.
So I think one thing which is dangerous with retirement is that you often think you want to do the fun things, or you want to do just relax and so on.
Yes.
But I think in the long run, I think that could be dangerous with retirement if you don't have things which you really feel are having demands on your having your feeling of actually doing something which feels worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to keep our activities, and not keeping activities is more and more dangerous the older you get.
Mm.
And I talk about meaningful activities.
Yes. What is a meaningful life is a question I always ask.
That is a question which is very different between different people. And I think that's very important to remember also.
Do you think culture has also got to do with what we consider a meaningful life?
Culture, yeah, of course. I mean, we are all influenced by our culture. But we need to think that it's also very individual what we think is meaningful life.
Mm.
And I had, when I did my PhD, I interviewed about 585-year-olds in the population. And one of the things we are looking at is, for instance, feeling tired of life, suicidal feelings. And it could be so that I came home to a person who had pain all over their bodies. They could only lay in bed, could hardly move.
Mm.
And as a 30-year-old doctor, I thought, this person must be tired of life. But instead they said, no, I'm not tired of life. I have pain everywhere. I can't move. But I want to know what is happening in the future. And I want to know what is going to happen with my grandchildren. So I don't want to die. And I think one of the most dangerous thing is that when people outside yourself decide what is a meaningful life.
Mm.
So as a doctor, you need to be very careful to decide that someone else has a meaningful life or not.
Mm. Because it is individual, like you said.
Yeah, and it's also so that we change our perspectives. So when we, with, for instance, increasing age, get more and more handicaps and more things we can't do, we are also changing our perspectives. And the human being is very good in changing their perspectives. So what a 25-year-old would find being completely unacceptable, when it comes to physical function and so on.
Yeah.
When you get older, you learn how to deal with it.
Right. Do you know, I had someone who said to me once that the older you get, the more conservative you get, the less likely you are to take chances and risk. And after our talk, I'm not sure I agree at all with what I was told some 20 years ago.
No, I mean, today we have a lot of older people who are very interested to learn more about digital media.
Yes.
Or computer or internet. Or so I don't think it is. It's one of these dangerous things that if people have pictures on how older people are.
Yes.
It's very easy that pictures will actually be forced on the older people themselves.
Mm.
Or I'm an older people now. So, but I mean, we as older people may be influenced by the view younger people have, which is also a dangerous thing.
I think it's just, yeah. Yes, I'm just, I just find it absolutely fascinating. I'm not sure I ever, do I look like, no, I don't really consider when I speak to a person, you know, how old you are. But I'm thinking about the attitudes, I guess, you know. So if I'm 70, you know, I'm expecting to have respect, that you show me respect, that I'm an older person. Do you know what I mean? So it's like that kind of attitude that might be also among our elderly.
I think older people are very different. You know, what we used to say is that the older people get, the more difference there are between people, because we develop in different ways.
Yes.
And the older you get, the more development you have had, because you've gone through much more things in life.
Mm.
And so actually, we often look at older people like one group. And instead, older people are more different than younger people. Younger people are quite uninteresting because they are so similar, all of them.
Okay. Mm. Now, I'm not sure about that, but it sounds interesting. I suppose the group mentality is also among young people. They don't want to stand out from each other too much, whereas the elderly, or as you get older, you don't really care.
Exactly. You realize that life changes all the time.
That's right. And
I think you get less deterministic with older age.
Yes.
You're young, you think things are like that, what you have now is going to be like it's going to be, the world is going to be like it's not going to change, things are going to be like it is. But when you live a couple of decades, you realize that things changes in ways we never could think.
Yes. How optimistic, final question, how optimistic are you about the future?
That depends on what you mean with the future.
You choose.
Is it related to aging or the world? Or
it's up to you.
Well, I think it's a lot of things which seems very bad when it comes to the world, because of, you know, it's the democratic societies are more and more challenged by more authoritarian governments and anti-democratic movements.
Mm.
And we also, of course, have the climate.
Mm.
And but in one way, I'm still optimistic, because I think that even if we have large changes, the human being is really very good in changing the perspectives. And really, that's why the human being has been so successful. We are very good in adapting to different environments or to different situations. So in that way, I'm very optimistic about the human being, although I'm very worried, especially about the anti-democratic movements.
Mm. What's next for you?
Well, I'm very close to retirement age, and it's a discussion whether I'm going to be able to continue or not. I am going to continue. I got a grant now for quite a large grant to get be able to look at the people born 1952-53. So I will probably continue with my research even after retirement.
But
it might be that I'm forced to retire.
Why would anyone force you to retire?
Well, I think they're very afraid that younger researchers wouldn't be able to get positions if the older ones doesn't.
Oh, discrimination.
Well, it is aging discrimination. It is.
Definitely. It's been an absolute privilege, Ingmar, to speak with you. I thank you so very much for sharing your thoughts, your research, and particularly your time. And I certainly hope that maybe in the future I can re-invite you back to have another talk, and again, you, your choice.
Yeah, I really liked our conversation, so it was very fun.
Yes, great fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And you have been listening to the podcast Sånt är livet i Sverige, or in English, That's Life here in Sweden, with me, Lisa Åsimäki. Till next time, take care of yourself and each other. Bye for now.